the whole idea about anti-Semitism is that you are creating an imagined Jew that doesn't actually exist in the world. And that is the exact same thing that happens in anti-Zionism. When people say I'm anti-Zionist, like the idea that they create this definition of Zionism and what a Zionist is that just bears no resemblance to reality. Like, and it bears no resemblance to how Zionists, to Zionists' own beliefs, their own experiences as Zionists or their own history as Zionists. So this is why anti-Semitism has been such an enduring and long hatred, is because it morphs, it changes, it manifests in different ways, you know, depending on what society needs.
Welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. Today, I have a conversation with Karis Rea, producer for Epoch Times. She's also worked with the Middle East Forum and the Jewish Leadership Project. We talk about Jew hatred on campuses and in general. We talk about a little bit about Israel, and we talk about the complications of what it means to be Jewish in today's world. I hope you enjoy the show. Karis Rea, welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. We're going to start with the video.
And we want to fund operations against soft targets. Schools, hospitals, Jewish cafes. I'm Ami Horowitz, and anti-Semitism is rising precipitously across the globe. How bad is it? I'm here at San Francisco State University, one of the most left-leaning intersectional schools in the country. I'm here to raise money to kill Jews. Money for arms and weapons to fight back against the Jews, operations
the
against
Jews.
The Jews, but around the world, in France, in Germany, here, in Britain, wherever they are, but here and in Europe, we want to raise arms so we can strike them all over the world. We have to hit these people hard.
Yeah.
And we want to fund operations against soft targets, schools, hospitals, Jewish cafes, hospitals, Jewish schools, Jewish buses, synagogues, that kind of thing. Targets that can make them really feel it. Attack, blow things up, blow shit up.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We have to strike back.
Yeah,
we
can't. No, I definitely agree.
All we have are rockets and suicide bombers and that kind of thing. The suicide bomber.
Because it's like part of their religion, like they wanted to take over.
People are evil in these worlds, so you know what I mean? They.
That's what we have to strike back.
Reasons. Yeah, most definitely.
So you think it's economic or think it's the religion motivating them?
I think it's a mix.
Keeping them controlled with like genocide.
A lot of people think they're superior to others, you know what I mean? So they think
they're superior.
Yeah, a lot of them think that.
Jew supremacy.
I think their behavior and the actions are evil.
Says they want the land. It's a money thing.
I don't know. I'm just heading to class.
You agree with what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
But yes, I would totally be down.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, bro, I agree with you.
I mean, you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
By hitting these targets.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I like what you're saying.
I would love to help.
You want to spread the word too?
Or? Spread the word for sure. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
God bless you.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't have money to give, but if you need word
but of mouth. But moral support, like, you can give me.
Yeah.
And just spread the message.
Like promotions, like putting on a story or something.
How much money would you be able to do? It's tax deductible.
A couple bucks.
Like five.
Also five? Like $5.
$5?
But yeah, five, ten.
Probably like $5.
$5
is great. 10?
Yeah, like 5 to 10.
Cool. Like $15 right now.
Say $15.
Damn.
That'd be amazing.
Like $15, $20 probably.
That'd be great.
Cool, 20.
A whole meal.
20?
Yeah.
Come on, brother. Come on, brother.
I don't really have a job right now, so.
Okay.
I would do like maybe $20.
$20.
I'd do 20.
$20.
Or 30?
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Peace and love.
Yes.
Peace and love. Peace and love.
Peace and love.
Peace and love.
Thank you.
Peace and love.
Great, everyone.
I couldn't have said it better myself. The rhetoric in demonizing Jews we have seen globally has led to this. 28 out of 35 people that I engaged in conversation with expressed support for what I was doing. And 17 out of 35, nearly 50% of people I spoke with, offered me money to kill Jews.
Okay, so let's be clear about one thing. Jews. He didn't say Israel. He specifically said Jews. So I invited you on today because I want to talk about anti-Semitism on college campuses, and I have a lot of questions for you, and then I'm going to ask you some kind of hard-hitting questions, if you're cool with that.
Totally cool with it, and I'm so excited to be talking about this with you.
Okay, great. I personally don't like the word anti-Semitism because I think Semitic peoples hide behind it to say that they can't be anti-Semitic because they're Semitic. And I like Jew hatred better.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, That's an interesting observation that you make, because it is frequently used by people of Arabic descent, right? When you criticize them for being anti-Semitic, they will say that is not possible because Correct. We are Semitic people. But that is a false argument, because if you look at the history of that term and where it came from, it was specifically coined to refer exclusively to Jewish people. It was coined in the 1800s by a German intellectual, or maybe he was a scientist, you know, someone of the intelligentsia or, you know, the elite class. And he had such a hatred of Jews in Germany. But, you know, this was post-Enlightenment and, you know, the appeals were to higher values of science and reason. And so he needed to make his hatred palatable. And he came up with the term anti-Semitism to make his hatred for Jews seem somewhat academic or scientific.
So do you agree with me that instead of anti-Semitism, we should call it for what it is? It's just Jew hatred. Or do you want to just stick with anti-Semitism?
I think either one is fine. I think we have bigger issues to worry about than focusing on the linguistics of what to call it. Anti-Semitism means Jew hatred, so they are synonymous as far as I'm concerned. And if anybody makes that argument about not being anti-Semitic because they themselves are Semites or Arabs are Semites,
that's the argument, yeah.
You can just kindly tell them what I just told you about where that word comes from, and, you know, they'll be put in their place easily, you know.
Okay. But
Jew hatred, some people say Judeophobia now, some people say Israelophobia.
I don't think it's Zionophobia. A phobia. I think it's a hatred.
Yeah, it's absolutely a hatred. And I think it was also an apt observation that you made when we watched that video, that you said Ami Horowitz said Jews,
right,
not Israel.
Correct.
And this is a perfect example of how anti-Zionism can be indistinguishable from anti-Semitism, because the people that he asked, the people that he solicited for funds and support, you know, some of them, you heard their responses to him, and they said things like, well, yeah, you know, because the Jews, they're taking the land stuff like that, right? So, but he didn't say anything about Israel or Zionists, right? And yet that's how these people took it. And that's why they supported him, because they were against Jews stealing the land. So,
unless the video was cut in a certain way that we didn't see. So I have to assume he has some integrity there, that he really was talking about Jews and not talking about Israel.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that we can safely say, given what we know about the history of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism on college campuses, and how we see so many examples of Hillels being, you know, defaced with the words Free Palestine, Chabad set on fire.
Hillels and Chabad, tell us what
those are. These are just Jewish centers of Jewish life on campuses. Nothing to do with Israel. Sometimes, depending on the Hillel, sometimes Hillels can be active in Zionist causes or pro-Israel causes, but sometimes they're not at all. It just depends on the specific Hillel. Chabad is just, you know, conservative Jews, you know, praying and expressing the religious aspects of their identity, right? Or there's those examples of these, you know, centers of Jewish life getting defaced regularly on college campuses.
So that's the question, like, how bad is it? So you study this. Is this common on college campuses?
It's bad. The question is it systemic? Now,
that's the question.
Some people would say, yes, anti-Semitism is systemic on college campuses today. I don't think it's systemic. And the reason why is because to me, the word systemic refers to an entire system. So that would basically mean that every college campus would have to be anti-Semitic. And that is not the case. Okay. It's not a problem on every single college campus. But what it is it's become institutionalized.
Okay. I'm going to push back on that. I'm not saying I believe that, but if the lens through which one views the world is oppressor and oppressed, and except by fiat that this is true. I personally don't believe this is true, but except by fiat that it's true, that people are viewing Jews as oppressors, mm-hmm. then it would be systemic. Like if that's the zeitgeist.
Right. So that is the general zeitgeist, but that is not the zeitgeist on every single college campus. There's a lot of college campuses in America, right. Okay? It's certainly true across like the more elite colleges, like the Ivy Leagues, and certainly universities on the coast, right? The most anti-Semitic campuses we see on universities tend to be like, you know, UC Berkeley, SF State, like in the video, and then also like the New York universities and colleges like CUNY. Oh my goodness, that's as bad as you can get. And then like Columbia and Rutgers. I mean, Rutgers and CUNY make Harvard look tame. Okay. So this is why I don't think it's systemic, because it's not on every campus, but it is certainly institutionalized, because in specific college campuses, it is endemic. It's created an environment of hostility for Jews.
And we've seen those videos online, like the NYU. Did you see that video at NYU? Let's just take a step back for a second. So let me ask you a question. So some things that I've been curious about. So why wasn't that more widely reported by before 10/7? Like why is that just, and then why are people not held accountable?
Right.
So the two questions there.
Why was it not more, you know, highly reported before 10/7? That's a great question. It's kind of like the question. I mean, people such as myself and other people I work with, we've been raising the alarm bell about, anti-Semitism on college campuses and beyond for over a decade. Post 2000, it just kind of exponentially worsened. And, you know, you asked me how bad is this problem? And I think that college campuses are really a microcosm for the state of anti-Semitism in America. And if you look at hate crime statistics, for example.
Yeah, let's go into some of those.
Jews are the victims of more religious hate crimes than any other religious group combined. So 60% of all religious hate crimes target Jews. That is more than any other religion combined. Not only that, Jews are the biggest victims of hate crimes per capita. Across the board, meaning adjusted for population, a Jew is twice as likely to be targeted in a hate crime as a black person. Okay.
And yet, Jews are 2% of the population.
Exactly. Less than about 2%. And yet, you know, do you see any Jewish Lives Matter protests? Of course not.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's a combination of a lot of factors. Man, that is, I mean, there are books written about this, right? I mean, anti-Semitism is a very unique and distinct type of hatred. It tends to be, in certain cases, much harder to recognize than any other forms of hatred, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah, please.
Most forms of hatred, when you think of like anti-Black racism or, you know, people who hate women or gay people or any hatred against any minority group, they usually consider the minority group inferior, lesser than, subhuman, right? And you do see that with Jews as well, right? Jews are, you know, especially like in the Holocaust, you know, Jews were described as pigs, filthy, dirty, vermin, insects, rodents. So there is that punching down when it comes to anti-Semitism. But simultaneously, there's also a punching up, which means that anti-Semitism at its core is a conspiracy in which the Jew is elevated to a position of sinister power or authority. The Jew is a character that pulls the strings, right? That manipulates the world's geopolitics. They control the media, they control the wars, they control the government, right? They have all the money, they have all the power. It's a sinister plot. And because anti-Semitism is fundamentally a conspiracy from its earliest days, when we think about anti-Semitism and the origins of it, even though it goes back further than this, but we tend to think of the original charge being that Jews killed Christ, right? This is what was kind of like the original charge of anti-Semitism. And
that's always, by the way, been bizarre to me. Well, because Christ was a Jew, so wouldn't people be happy about that?
I mean, well, I think that gets into more
I don't want to get into the domain of theology. Yeah,
that gets into.
But it's always been a bizarre charge to me.
It's very bizarre. It gets into the whole.
The Jews killed Christ, but Christ was a Jew.
Of course, it gets into the whole kind of history of Christianity, and you're getting into kind of the Jesus movement, which preceded the Christ movement, and then you know the people that wrote the history about Christ. But going back to kind of anti-Semitism and it being a conspiracy, that was kind of the original conspiracy. And then when religion, you know, as history progressed and religion was kind of replaced with science and the Enlightenment as the highest ideal that a society could ascribe to, suddenly Jews were not, you know, hated for their religion anymore. They were hated for their race, right? Suddenly we became a race, right? And Jews essentially throughout history have been the scapegoat for societies. So when a society is suffering economically or in any way, or there's some sort of natural disaster or a plague, you look to a group to blame the people that are secretly, that secretly made this happen. So whether it's the Jews that brought the plagues or that are poisoning the water or that are killing the children to make their matzah, it's always this conspiracy.
Yes. But
the reason why this answers your question about why this isn't being highly reported is because it's difficult to recognize that type of hatred, because it's not a hatred that looks down upon somebody as like a lesser, you know, creature. It's somebody that's more like, ooh, they're actually all powerful. They have all the money. They're controlling this. They're controlling that. And there are people with power and privilege and money, and we should talk about that. And, you know, journalists do, and we report on that. And so these don't seem like anti-Semitic charges. They don't seem like, right? Does this make sense?
Yeah. So I'm trying to work this out. So, okay. So for a very long time, I don't know when you want to first date it, and then, you know, leaping forward to the protocols of the elders of Zion or what have you. Like, so why do you think there's a hatred of Jews? Like, I've never been able to understand that. Like, what is the why?
I think people need somebody to blame. I think you need a scapegoat in society, and Jews have always been a convenient scapegoat. I think it's as simple as that. But I also don't think it's necessarily productive to ask the question, because
to ask the question why?
Why people hate Jews, because it's the same as people hating any minority for, you know, no good reason. I mean, people hate, people judge unfairly.
See, that's interesting, yeah.
And I do think it's kind of odd that people tend to ask this question of why people hate Jews, but nobody sits around and says, why do people hate black people? For some reason, people seem to think there's.
But that's because I think people at core know why some people hate black people.
Why?
Well, I think some people hate black people because they think they're inferior, and they think that they're stupid.
Right. So then people hate Jews, I think, for... I think one, they think they're inferior. They think they're either like filthy or impure.
Okay, so that's something I never got. But okay, so let's just say that's true.
Okay, that's one reason. The second reason is because of what I just said. They think that they are responsible for society's ills. They are responsible for what's going wrong with society. Okay,
well, that's just like insane.
Okay, and I think the other reason, the other reason that people hate Jews is because Jews are in some countries largely successful. Like in America.
See, that's what I think it is.
And people, as we've seen what's happened with Asians in Haiti.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it's success envy is part of it.
I think success envy is a huge part. And what's so ironic about that is the very reason why Jews tend to be successful in the first place is because of the exclusionary and the discriminatory laws and practices that have existed throughout history against Jews that have forced them to get innovative and creative and force them to, you know, take up jobs and professions in fields that they would have otherwise not gone into, right? Like money, like lending, like money right. lending and things like that, or the arts, because of anti-Semitism, because of systemic and anti-Semitism and discriminatory laws, Jews have been forced to kind of really fend for ourselves and get creative and try to figure out how to be self-sufficient.
Okay, so I'll tell you a story. So my mentor was Jewish. His name is, well, his German Jewish name was Franz Wolfson. And he escaped and went to America. And then he liberated the very same concentration camp in which he was interned in Buchenwald.
Wow.
Yeah, it's awesome, awesome human being. But he told me something really interesting. When he was in the concentration camp, the younger Nazis were far worse to him than the older Nazis, because the older Nazis, like his father, fought in World War I, and the older Nazis didn't view it, you know, Judenblut, didn't view it as a bloodline. They viewed it as kind of religion or thing. But the younger Nazis had it like it was something in you, and they had a particular animosity, and they just despised him. Yeah, and they were just whipping. I mean, the stories he told me was insane. Yeah. But my question to you is, so, and I realize this is a very complicated question, but do you think educated people are more anti-Semitic?
This is such an interesting question and such an important question.
Let's linger on it if you don't mind.
Because I think when people think about racism, they tend to ascribe characteristics of being poor, uneducated, right? Maybe like redneck or something, to people who are racist, right? And yet, when it comes to anti-Semitism, there's actually been studies that show that the more educated you are, the more anti-Semitic you are. Let's unpack that a little bit. And before we do, we can even see, if we go back in modern history, that that is correct. Look at something like the Holocaust, right? I mean, the prominent Nazis who pushed this this hateful ideology the most, these were lettered individuals. Okay?
Most of them, not like Himmler and stuff, but yeah, most of them.
Not all of them, but but a lot of Nazis were prominent intellectuals of the day. And same with the Inquisition. The people who started the Inquisition, these were enlightened people, so to speak. So originally, I think the view was more that, no, uneducated people are more anti-Semitic because those are the rednecks, those are the neo-Nazis, those are the white supremacists. But recent studies have shown, there was one in particular, in which researchers interviewed faculty and students and administrators on college campuses. And first, they looked at all the other studies that had been done that kind of showed the original belief, which is that uneducated people are actually more anti-Semitic. And they realized that there was a problem with the questions, that the questions were very straightforward, kind of like, how do you feel about Jews, kind of, right? Like, just kind of asking people about very blatant stereotypes of Jews. And educated people, who are presumably good test takers, right? They know which answers are right and wrong. They know how to answer those types of questions. They know what the researchers are measuring when they say, how do you feel about Jews?
Jew
right?
hatred.
Yeah, of course. So they, you know, so they'll say, no, I have no problem with Jews or anything like that, right? And then they come up with, you know, they come to the conclusion, oh, well, educated people are not anti-Semitic. But once you change how you phrase the question, and the people who you're interviewing do not know what you are measuring, what you are testing for, the exact opposite happens. So here's the kind of questions they started asking people. They took what's called the 3D test of anti-Semitism. Nathan Sharansky, do you know who that is? He's what they call a refusenik. He was a Soviet dissident, a Jewish. And he was held in a Soviet prison for a long time. And then he made aliyah and he went to Israel. And now he fights for human rights and for the Jewish people and against Soviet ideology that now manifests in the form of like wokeism and far leftism. But anyway, so he came up with a test for how to determine if something is anti-Semitic. It's called the 3D test of anti-Semitism. If what you're saying or doing meets these three characteristics, you're holding. It was basically a 3D test to see
What are they?
If delegitimization, demonization, and double standard. The researchers took one of these characteristics that Natan Sharansky gave, the double standard, to measure this. And what they did was they went into higher education and they asked people questions such as, during the pandemic, do you think it's okay for Orthodox Jews to gather for funerals? And then they asked another group of people, during the pandemic, do you think it's okay for Black Lives Matter to protest, right? Here's another question. They said, if you're an American and you want to articulate a foreign policy decision, is it a problem if you declare your support for Israel? And then they asked another group, if you want to express a foreign policy, you know, what you believe America should do about foreign policy as an American, is it a problem if you profess your loyalty to Mexico, right?
Okay, so So I don't want to bring in any new conversations or topics because this is, we could literally talk about it. Okay, so.
And you can imagine what the results were.
Right, so we need to talk about this. There's so much just on the table right now. So the first thing is that the claim is that racism is a public health crisis.
Right.
I know, it's insane, but that's the claim. Uh-huh. And so like, a better kind of control question for that would have been, but a more obvious one, right? Would have been like, well, are Pentecostals in the COVID plague allowed to? But help me understand this.
There was a lot of questions that they asked. Those were just a few.
Help me understand this. Okay, so educated people. I don't mean to sound anything other than what it is. What is their problem with Jews?
Yeah. Okay,
like,
so here's
I don't get it.
Okay, here's the problem.
And I want to say one more thing. You know, I'm going to push back on your response before because you said, well, there's hatred about everything. So mm-hmm. like whether you like it or not, you know, some people believe that there's, you know, race realism or genetics in you know, Black underaccomplishment or what have you, or resentment because of affirmative action. Okay, so to be clear, I'm not saying this is good. I'm saying like that's a reason. Mm-hmm. I don't get the reason for people hating Jews. Like I legitimately do not understand why. Like if you're going to say, well, you know, when Noam Dowd Ashkenazi Jews are higher, we know that IQs are higher. We know that from, you know, identical twins, separate births. Okay, if that's going to be a reason, that would seem like more of a reason to like them.
Like, yeah, but the reasons that people hate Jews are based on false assumptions about Jews. Jews are just falsehoods.
I should have said educated people.
About Jews. So, I mean, even the question presumes that there has to be a legitimate premise to even, and there's just not.
So bracketing the whole Christ-killing thing, which is just, we don't even know if there was a historical Jesus, but just bracketing that for a second. So, you know, I start off by saying, are educated people more likely to be anti-Semitic? And that is still in my head because I really don't like the word anti-Semitic. So I'm going to change that.
Okay.
So are educated people more likely to hate Jews? Mm-hmm. Let's say we got someone in here who is like honest about it because most people won't be honest about stuff. Why would they dislike Jews?
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because higher education is largely leftist. It subscribes to a left-wing or progressive ideology, right? Not necessarily liberal, but like an actual—
Anti-liberal, I would say.
Yeah, anti-liberal, right? Regressive leftists, I guess was a term people used about a decade ago. Yeah, I'm not sure why.
It's Majid Nawaz's term. Anyway,
it's a great term. I don't know where it went. It's one of my favorites. But higher education, administrators, faculty— they're largely progressive. They embrace a progressive ideology. That progressive ideology is highly, highly influenced by the Soviet Union.
Okay.
The Soviet Union exported in very targeted and specific ways an ideology that encompassed anti-Zionism. Okay, which is the same as anti-Semitism, just rebranded. Okay,
we're going to go over that too.
And we'll get into that. And they filtered it into groups in which the members or their members' kids or whatever are now the people that are teaching in our institutions today. Okay, so what is that ideology? What is it comprised of? There's a few things. Number one, you touched on this at the beginning. Jews are considered oppressors, okay? Right? Because in left-wing politics, as we know, the intersectional hierarchy reveals to us that everybody is divided into either an oppressed or an oppressor category, okay? Now, obviously, Jews, as one of the most persecuted minorities since time immemorial,
correct,
should fall into the oppressed category.
Correct.
Especially given everything I just told you about the statistics and the fact that we are literally the most victimized group per capita in America, okay? We've been exiled and kicked out of 109
pogroms,
countries, okay?
Murders.
Pogroms, holocausts, inquisitions,
sure.
So one, from time
one,
immemorial.
One would think that would...
Right.
Right.
Exactly. But because of what I said at the beginning, which is that anti-Semitism is fundamentally a conspiracy in which the Jews are seen as having undue power and influence. So leftists, which divide the world into power or powerlessness, naturally put Jews in the category of the people with the power and the privilege, because that is what anti-Semitism does on the right or on the left. Jews are considered all power. They are considered having undue power and influence. Anti-Semitism, which is, they say it's the world's oldest hatred, and it unites the left and the right. Have you ever heard the phrase horseshoe anti-Semitism? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it means that when you go far enough on the left or far enough in the right, it loops back around and it tends in the same direction, which is why you see, you know, people like David Duke praising Ilhan Omar, or you see both the right and the left, like, you know, taking up these BDS campaigns against Israel. It's because they view Jews the same way. Jews are powerful. And on the left, one thing that's different on the left and the right is that, yes, in both cases, the Jew is seen as powerful and manipulative and pulling the strings. But on the left, they're also seen as white. Jews are seen as white.
Correct.
Now, that is false for two reasons.
Yeah, let's go into that.
Yeah, so the right, the far right sees Jews as non-white, anti-white, actually. They see the Jews as being responsible for pushing globalism, encouraging immigration,
pornography,
destroying the white man's America.
Correct.
Okay, but on the left,
that's caused by the Jew. Yeah, and
right.
Yeah,
but on the left, power and privilege are associated with whiteness.
Yeah,
because Jews are seen, like on the right, as having power and privilege, they're automatically lumped into the category of whiteness. Also, they're lumped into that category because most Jews in America are Ashkenazi. They are of Eastern European descent, so they do look white. Even though we all come from the Levant, so we're all indigenous to the Middle East, you know, where we span multiple races and ethnicities, and Jews in America are largely of Eastern European descent. So we're pushed into this category. Jews are automatically seen as essentially irredeemable and even evil, because whiteness is evil. And the reason why this idea about white Jews is such a modern day Jew-hating canard is because...
You picked up my lingo there.
I did, very deliberately. Is because, one, if you look at a country like Israel, in which half...
I don't want to go there just yet, but okay.
It's not political. In which half the world's Jews live, more than half of the Jews in Israel are brown. They're of Sephardi or Mizrahi descent. They're from the Middle East or North Africa, and they look indistinguishable from their Arab brothers and sisters. So the idea that Jews are white is hilarious, and it would be news to them, right? Nobody thinks they're white in Israel. The other reason why it's so pernicious and why it's such an insidious form of Jew hatred is because 6 million Jews were slaughtered in the Holocaust. That's 2 out of 3 Jews in Europe. 1/3 of all Jews on earth were slaughtered for the very reason that we were considered not white, not Aryan. So which is it? Jews can't win. we're either demonized because we're not white, or we're demonized because we are white. We're either demonized for being responsible for the plagues and the wars and the bad economies in Europe and told to go to Palestine, or we are being demonized for having our own state and supposedly being colonialists and we should get out of Palestine and go back to Europe. Which is it? And this is why anti-Semitism is a uniting hatred. And this is why over the centuries we've seen Jews being blamed for being communists and capitalists.
Yeah, Marx right? was a Jew. That's why Hitler hated him.
Whatever villain society needs to blame for their problems, Jews will fill that role.
Okay, so are you an Ashkenazi Jew?
Yes.
Okay, so do you view yourself, and maybe if this is too personal of a question, let me know. Do you view yourself as white?
Mm-mm.
What do you view yourself as?
Jewish.
And what does that like mean?
You know, I think that growing up, I would have said Caucasian, but now that I really understand my history and my ancestry, and I understand that all Jews are from the Levant.
Where's the Levant?
It's the Middle East. It's Israel. Now that I understand that, I realize that Judaism precedes the idea of race. And so it doesn't even fit into like the construct, especially not the American construct of like white versus black. That idea of like race or racism is a very Americanized Western idea of racism. It's and you see it being imposed onto the Middle East, like, oh, the Palestinians are brown and the Israelis are white. It's very like kind of like Euro or American centric to do that, to like impose, you know, to project our own ideas of race onto other regions of the world.
It really has
nothing to do with that.
So
now when I go into like a doctor's office and it says, what race are you? I always put other.
So do you, okay, so I have to,
but I have no problem with people thinking I'm white. And you know,
I don't mean to be overly personal, but I'm trying to separate things. Are you religious? Like, do you participate in the?
No, I always say I'm like the worst Jew, but the biggest Zionist.
Okay. Let's go. Okay. So you're identifying as a Jew mm-hmm. is not because, you know, you participate in any like, because there are people who are culturally Jewish. Mm-hmm. Some good friends of mine are called Reform Jews, culturally mm-hmm. Jewish, but they don't accept the metaphysics. But mm-hmm. let's pause on that. So this guy I was doing jiu-jitsu with this morning was making jokes about him being Asian. So like he was making jokes about himself being Asian. So like he identifies as an Asian. And so you identify as what? Like Jewish or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And American and Jewish.
Yeah. Okay. So
if people say, what's your heritage?
Yeah.
I would say Ashkenazi Jewish.
Okay.
That's what I would say.
Okay. So I'm always overwhelmed in these conversations because they can just go so many places.
Well, you know, I know. But, you know, it's interesting because your question actually goes to show how Judaism is not just a religion. And people frequently will defend their anti-Semitism by saying, like, Jews are just a religion. Or they'll say something like, you know, there shouldn't be, you know, a Jewish state because there shouldn't be a religious democracy, right? As if there's not like 56 Muslim majority countries, right? And when you reduce Judaism to a religion,
yeah,
you are really erasing like Jewish history and Jewish identity. There is a reason why you cannot believe in a Jewish God. You can not celebrate Shabbat or any of the Jewish traditions and still very, very deeply and historically identify as a proud Jew. And it is because being Jewish is more than a religion. We are a people.
Okay.
We are a nation with our own culture, with our own history, with our own language. What religion in the world has their own language?
You know those genetic tests, 23andMe? Mm-hmm.
Perfect example of how we're not just a religion.
Okay.
How could there be traits? How could you show up on a 23andMe test? How could it tell you that you're Ashkenazi?
Yeah, Tay-Sachs syndrome or what
have
you.
Of course. Right. Of course.
So let's say that you took a 23andMe or whatever they some test mm-hmm. like that. And it came back and it said you were 0% Ashkenazi or 0% Jewish. Would you still consider yourself Jewish?
Oh, wow. That's a really interesting question. I would, because of how I was raised, sure, right? I mean, you can still convert to Judaism.
But then it would be a religion.
Well, religion is a fundamental element of Judaism.
Yeah.
Without the religious aspect, there would be no Judaism. Okay, religion is what?
Judaism,
there would
correct.
Be no Judaism, right?
But there would be Jews.
There would be Jews, but if there was no religious aspect of Judaism, even just starting now, over time, Jews would disappear because they would assimilate, they would marry non-Jews, this and this and that. And so the religious aspect, the people who actually practice and carry on the traditions, the religious traditions, are the people who carry on our legacy and guarantee the survival of our people. Another reason why anti-Semitism is such an insidious hatred is because the conspiracy theory of Jews, controlling the world does not comport with the actual demographics and the numbers. If you look at how many Jews there are in the world compared to Muslims or Christians, Israel-Palestine is just like, you know, the press is like, zoom, right? Like academic, right? The humanities is like, zoom, everything is Israel, Israel, Israel. Just like, let's focus in. This is as if there's, a dozen other countries in the Middle East going through, crazy internal strife and civil war and turmoil, right? Everything's about Israel. Everything's about Jews. And yet Jews make up there's 15 million Jews in the world.
Yeah.
Now, that number might not register to people, but when you tell them that there's about 1.5 billion Christians, about, I think, 1.4 billion Muslims, and 15 million Jews, and yet the Jews are the ones, this tiny, tiny group of people, they're the ones that are pulling the strings. It's so outrageous. And if we are the ones that are responsible for all the,
if you're pulling the strings, you're not doing a great job.
I was just going to say. because we've been on the brink of extinction for quite a while.
Yeah. So are you more comfortable with somebody who's not Jewish or somebody who is an Orthodox Jew? And I'll tell you why I asked the question, because just recently I was someplace and I was with a woman I just met literally that hour, and somebody else came walking into the corridor, and it was a kind of a formal thing. So I put out my hand and I shook, and I saw him, and it's Peter. And he told me his name. And then the woman I was with, she put out her hand and he said, I don't shake the hands of women.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a funny story about my comment, my follow-up to him. I really pushed him on that. But are you more comfortable with somebody who is Orthodox in their views, or are you more comfortable with someone who's not Jewish?
That depends what you mean by comfortable. It really depends in what context. There'd be some contexts where I'd be more comfortable with an Orthodox Jew, and other contexts where, if I want to go party, I'm going to be more comfortable with like a non-Jew, if I'm in a situation where, I'm being discriminated against for, then I'll probably want an Orthodox Jew around who I can, bond with over that,
How important is it, do you think, to Jewish people that, because I hear this is one of the tropes that I hear.
But also it depends what you mean by Orthodox, because modern Orthodox is very different than if you're talking about like a Hasidic Jew, it depends.
Or someone from Bedford-Stuyvesant or something. So
that would be the Hasids. And even within the Hasidic community, the Satmar Jews are very different than the Chabadniks.
Yeah.
I'm much more comfortable with the Chabadniks. That's a much more liberal form of Hasidism than the Satmars. That's much more of like a rigid conservative interpretation of Judaism.
So back to this idea of why people hate Jews. Mm-hmm. I've been fascinated by that idea for a long time. Mm. So you mentioned the word success before. But do you think it has anything to do with the fact that Ashkenazi Jews in particular, they're just smarter in general? I mean, we know that when you norm out IQs.
Yeah, but I think it's an evolutionary thing. I think Jews have had to, I think they've
but
had
do you
to
be do you think that's why
to
people,
survive.
Do you think that's why people dislike Jews? Because
sure, I think envy is a huge, I think envy is a component, but it's one component.
Yeah.
Because remember, there's not one reason, because Jews can be anything that people need them to be. So they're not hated for one reason. They're hated for a whole bunch of reasons, because anti-Semites create whatever they want the Jew to be. There's a saying that anti-Semitism says more about the anti-Semite than it does about Jews.
For sure.
The whole idea about anti-Semitism is that you are creating an imagined Jew that doesn't actually exist in the world. And that is the exact same thing that happens in anti-Zionism. When people say I'm anti-Zionist, like the idea that they create this definition of Zionism and what a Zionist is that just bears no resemblance to reality. Like, and it bears no resemblance to how Zionists' own beliefs, their own experiences as Zionists, or their own history as Zionists. So this is why anti-Semitism has been such an enduring and long hatred, is because it morphs, it changes, it manifests in different ways, depending on what society needs and, what society's struggling with. And so we'll be demonized because we're not white at one point in time. And in 2024, we'll be demonized because we are white.
The Quidian nature of it is that it perseveres.
Mm-hmm. And it perseveres because it can morph. But what's interesting is, like, you'll see there is like classic anti-Semitic tropes that, you know, kind of always exist, but like they take on different, it's like at its core, the same tropes are there, but they take on
Give
different
me some.
Shapes.
Give me some.
Okay. So like, you know, one, you know, you used to hear in the World War II era about, you know, talk about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Jewish lobby, right? The Jewish lobby, the secret cabal of Jews that are controlling the world, right? And now it's, you hear about the Israel lobby, right? It's no longer the Jewish lobby. That's an anti-Semitic trope. Nobody will say that, except like white supremacists, you know? So now they say the Israel lobby. The Israel lobby is the one that's controlling the U.S. government. They have all the money and they're, you know, determining our foreign policy, right? And when really their allegiance is to Israel. Absolute nonsense. AIPAC is a very, very small lobby compared to other lobbies in Washington, like the Qatari lobby, for example, which nobody talks about, right? I mean, there's many countries who have their own lobbies and have incredible influence over many of our institutions in DC and beyond. And once again, it's only the Jewish lobby that is singled out. Another one would be another anti-Semitic trope that kind of, shape shifts, but is still fundamentally at its core the same, would be Jews poisoned the wells, right? Now there's a trope that, you know, Israel poisons the water in the West Bank. They give the Palestinians poisoned water to drink, right? So, you know, the context is different, but the trope is the same.
So I'm just going to throw out things that I've heard over the years. Jews will only go to other Jews for business. A Jew will go out of his way to...
I don't know if I'm qualified to say that. I mean, I don't know. I think people tend...
Because I'm trying to think of like...
Yeah, I mean, look, that might generally be true, but I'm sure that there are a ton of exceptions. I mean, my dad is Jewish and he's in business, and I don't think he, actually he's staying at a former business partner's house in Jerusalem who had a bagel store, Noah's Bagels in California. But other than that, no, I mean, he's in the food business and he doesn't work with other Jews at all. That's probably one of those things where it's like generally true, but there's probably more actual exceptions to the rule. But I think I think that speaks to a greater kind of this very natural kind of inclination that humans have to be with their tribe and belong and to be with their people. And I don't think there's anything wrong. I mean, I think that's because I think if you look in the Muslim community, I think that that would probably be the same thing. I would say that that probably generally applies as well.
Yeah, I was
thinking. And yet there are a lot of exceptions.
I was thinking about belonging and like the claim that, you know, Jews will marry other Jews. But, you know, my dad wanted me, well, he didn't like, you know, force me or anything, obviously, but he thought it would be good if I married an Armenian, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think I agree. I think it's a human thing. It's a kind Absolutely. Of like, but I'm trying to
think. People are bonded by their shared history.
Yeah. And nobody would hate me if I had married an Armenian. But why would you be mad at someone who's Jewish who, like, I'm still trying, maybe I'm trying to make sense of something in which there's no sense.
What was the end of that question?
Well, I was just trying to think, like, if nobody is mad at a Muslim because they want to marry a Muslim or Armenian, because you could do it by ethnicity, then why would people be upset that Jews want to marry other Jews?
Oh, okay. Well, this points to one of the fundamental components of anti-Semitism, which is the double standard. Jews are held to a different standard.
Oh, of the three things?
Absolutely. Yeah. Jews are held to a different standard that other people aren't held to. I think one of the reasons why it's important for Jews, not necessarily for me personally, but in general, why Jews think it's important for them to marry within the religion is just because of...
Within the religion, the word religion used.
Right. I think people think that's important just because there's so few Jews in the world. And so I think people feel this kind of collective need to preserve. It's like a self-preservation. Jews are worried about going extinct at some point. And I think that they feel like in order to persevere and to carry on as a people, they have to reproduce with other Jews. And I think that's a very important value for certain Jews.
Okay. So you have these, I think the double standard, we talk about the double standard. And we also have, I remember when Jews were being beaten in the streets in the pandemic, I would put out a couple of tweets, you know, and I gave some statements about, like, why don't universities criticize this? Like, universities are literally freaking out about, like, the most insignificant, I don't even believe there's such a thing as a microaggression, but the most insignificant, like, slights against certain groups of people. But, and I said, and then this is maybe where we can segue into Israel, but to be completely clear with you, this is way outside my area of expertise. I am not a geopolitics guy. But universities didn't put anything out about that.
Right.
Like,
right.
Hey, let's not beat people in the streets or beat them out of the streets because of their, like, there was nothing.
Right.
And I kept kind of pounding that home.
Right.
So explain that to
us. Because
Jews
aren't looked at as a protected class on college campuses because of the whole framework, because of the whole intersectionality, DEI, CRT framework in which Jews are seen as white oppressors and therefore they are not deserving of our protection. Okay, so if you look at DEI curriculum, hardly any of them have any component of teaching about anti-Semitism. It's just not a part of it. And if it is,
I can say that that's.
And if it is, it's only teaching about, like, far right anti-Semitism and white supremacy. And the reason is because DEI boards and administrators and teachers themselves perpetuate and perpetrate anti-Semitism. It is coming out.
I agree 1,000%.
I mean, if you look at there is over the last decade, or really much more in the last, like, 5 years, but there is example after example after example of a DEI administrator, whatever, on Stanford or Harvard or whatever, coming out, you know, as having said atrocious things, you know, on social media about Jews, you know? I mean, and not even like Zionists or Israel, but just stuff like Jews are white. Usually they'll say things like this: Jews are complicit in white supremacy, right? Or Jews...
I hear that a lot.
Yeah, or Jews have... Jewish privilege is like a big thing that DEI, the DEI groups talk about, right? So, you know, and sometimes they'll just... Or sometimes they'll even be really kind of classic medieval tropes. Like, every anti-Semitic canard in the book, like, has been found as being alleged by some, or as being expressed by some sort of DEI person somewhere on some college campus.
Okay, so let me ask you some questions that I'm sure people are thinking about. So when you see somebody in a DEI board who's Jewish... Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? Because I'm thinking of someone very specific I know What do you think about that? And let me ask you a question that is potentially incendiary, but what do you think of the concept of the self-hating Jew?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting and compelling phenomenon. There have been books written on it throughout history. There have been Jews who have pushed for prescriptions to problems or policies to the Jewish problem that would actually end in our own destruction.
Like Otto Weininger.
You're basically asking a more palatable question, which is, why are Jews liberal? First of all,
I wouldn't have used the word liberal, but okay. Yeah, but
They're not globally.
Yeah.
But they are largely in America. But if you look at, even in Europe, if you look at like the community of like Jews in Britain or in a place like Chile in South America, you know, there aren't many Jews in the world other than in America or in Israel. Jews feel very, very safe in America. But in places where the Jewish community is very, very small, whether they're secular or more religious doesn't matter, but they tend to be more conservative, okay? In America, Jews are largely liberal because, you know, after the Holocaust, anti-Semitism looked increasingly like a kind of exclusively right-wing phenomenon. Why? Because we were never taught in schools about Soviet anti-Semitism and the endemic systemic Jew hatred that was found within left-wing ideology. The line of Jew hatred throughout left-wing ideology and history as it developed is as clear and apparent as it has been on far-right ideology as it developed, whether it was, you know, Christianity all the way into like far-right fascism. And yet, Jews in America, they're not taught about the history of anti-Semitism on the left.
Okay.
So Jews imagine that liberalism is the ideology that protects them because they don't know any better.
Okay.
I also think, more thing. I also think that going, you know, these are just theories, right, about why Jews are liberal. I don't really have an answer, but these are my theories. And there are books written about, you know, this as well. One theory is that as a religion, Judaism is kind of far more liberal than like Christianity or Islam. It's, you know, questions are encouraged. If you look at something like the Talmud, all it is interpretations. And I mean, not all it is, but you know, I mean, it's just filled with questions and sort of Socratic dialogue of rabbis trying to interpret, you know, Jewish ethics and stuff like that. So it's just a much more kind of like liberal creed in that sense. And so there might be something to that. Like there might be something in the Jewish DNA and our identity going back, you know, to the origins of Judaism, which tend to make us more not left wing, but more liberal, more to the left of the spectrum. Maybe that's a reason too.
Can you understand, and it's 100% okay to say no, can you understand the frustration of many white heterosexual men who have friends who are Jewish and they're telling them these people and DEI boards and universities are literally insane and they're harassing the shit out of me, and then their Jewish friends rolled their eyes, and then post October 7th, now they're all of a sudden on the bandwagon. Now they're all of a sudden like upset, whereas about mm-hmm. the discriminate. But before...
Yeah.
Can you understand why someone would be frustrated by that?
Well, sure, because I myself have been frustrated by it. I mean, look, I've worked for various nonprofits that have been trying to shine a light on the anti-Semitism in college campuses and beyond for over a decade. And part of that has been trying to get legacy Jewish organizations and Jewish leaders to actually step up and address the problem and confront the problem. They didn't until now. It was a really big wake up call. I mean, this is why the Jewish Leadership Project, of which I am a fellow, was formed. It was because.
So why didn't they?
So they didn't for a number of reasons. Number one, Jewish leaders, legacy organizations, are ideologically conflicted and conflict averse. Okay? Jews in America have finally, you know, over time, gotten to a place, right? Because remember, less than 100 years ago, there were Jewish quotas in universities. There were signs on benches.
Still are at Harvard, by the way.
Right? There were signs on benches that said, no Jews, no dogs, okay? Like, anti-Semitism was a thing in America, like it was everywhere else in the world until not so long ago. And now Jews are finally in a place in society where we are, where we feel safe and equal. And I think Jews are very hesitant about rocking that boat, right? I think that they've made a lot of like allies. And if they come out against some of those allies, right? If they come out against Black Lives Matter, which is very anti-Semitic, right? They're like, oh my God, we're going to lose the Black community, right? So I think they're scared. I think Jewish leaders are scared to address the problem of left-wing anti-Semitism.
So they're cowards.
Totally.
Okay. Well,
and I also think they're ideologically conflicted because they themselves are liberal, because they inaccurately diagnose the problem of anti-Semitism being a right-wing phenomenon exclusively. Right? Why? Again, because they weren't taught about it, right? And also, I think that they inaccurately, and this is something that they've believed throughout history, this gets into like Reform Judaism and assimilationism and stuff. They believe that like if people hate us, there must be something wrong with us. And so if we can just be more like everybody else, if we can assimilate, if we can marry outside of our religion, if we can, you know,
then what? Then
we will finally be accepted. We will not be singled out as Jews. We will not be hated.
Well, then there'd be no Jews.
Exactly. And this is the problem that people have with like Reform or Reconstructionism. They believe it's an attempt to kind of assimilate Jews. And therefore, it's kind of a prescription for, over time, us dying out, right? I mean, in Reform, like Reform Jews don't go to the synagogue. They go to the temple, right? I mean, not all Reform synagogues are progressive or anything like that, but they're definitely more liberal. That's what the whole movement is, the whole Reform movement. And I think there's a lot of elements to this, and you could really kind of do a deep dive on each one.
You know, if I may, so back to this Armenian thing. Many Armenians have big noses. I have kind of a big nose. Uh-huh. And my cousin, Eddie, years ago, was here in California, was driving in California, and he was pulled over by a cop. And the cop said to him, give me your ID, you big-nosed Jewish bastard.
Oh, my God.
But I have been, it's interesting, I'm not Jewish, but I've been, quote-unquote, accused of being Jewish. I think it's maybe kind of Semitic, with the nose or something. I don't really know what it is. But it's always been interesting to me. Like, nobody would kind of accuse me of being Black. I wouldn't know what that felt like.
Right.
But it's always been interesting to me when somebody has said something like that to me. Like, you know, a couple times I've been called a c-.
Yeah. You know, one time I was standing outside Whole Foods, and some presumably homeless guy came up to me and he said, can I have a dollar? And I said, I didn't even say no. I just said, I'm sorry. And he said, you lying Jew. And I, in my head, I'm like, how does he know I'm Jewish? And then I realized he doesn't. It's just that he uses the word Jew like somebody would use the word asshole.
Oh,
it's just a pejorative to him. It's just because I'm not giving him money.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. So I've been really interested about this for a while. Like, it's so interesting to me how I think it's less common now, but like for like 5 or 7 years, everybody on the left was just slinging around the word Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
Nazi, right. Nazi. Everyone's a freaking Nazi. And I just remember seeing myself like, I just can't, like, that is the most demeaning of a Nazi. Like to call me or a random person like a Nazi or, you know, all the videos of.
Well, it's like calling somebody a racist.
Yeah, the Antifa people in Toronto or Canada calling that old woman a Nazi who wanted to go to the Peterson event or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so crazy to me to demean that.
I know. I mean, can you imagine what Jews are facing now on college campuses? They are being absorbed into the same category as their oppressors. As the white supremacists. Jews are now the white supremacists. Israel is now a Jewish supremacy state. The term, the phrase Jewish supremacy is so common on college campuses to refer to Israel.
I've heard it twice recently.
But do you know where that phrase comes from? It was coined by David Duke. He wrote a book called Jewish Supremacism.
I did not know that. I'm not a fan. I'm not a voter.
It's a uniting hatred. I mean, swastikas are so common on college campuses.
I know, I had one on my door. So what do you make of this idea that when an Asian person is attacked by a black person, these are very common, or at least they were, the far left is out screaming about white supremacy. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, but they did the same thing with Jews in Brooklyn.
How so?
When
the African Americans were attacking Jews, it was white supremacy.
Of course, that's what Bill de Blasio said. I mean, he got he kind of he backtracked on that. Rashida Tlaib said that they blamed the, you know, there was like for a good about a year there, like every week there was an instance of like a black individual aggressing upon a visibly Jewish person in New York City, whether beating them up or spitting on them or throwing something at them. I mean, it was very scary. I think the anti-Semitic incidents against Jewish people went up by 400% in 1 year, I think from 2020 to 2021 in New York City. And like over 80% of these attacks, in over 80%, the perpetrators were either black or Hispanic. And yet it was still white supremacy?
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's a blind spot that the left
has. It's interesting because one of the reasons that the far right, and I'm trying to think, I used to listen to the guy's podcast. I can't remember his name. One of the reasons that they hate Jews is because they're kind of this responsible for a kind of liberalism that grants civil rights to people. And they hate blacks, but they think that blacks are too stupid to do that themselves. And the Jew has been the vehicle for the, And so I've always found that thinking to be fascinating. And, you know, I remember, I'm concerning my age here, you're probably too young, but I remember, you know, remember the TV show Oz? Is this HBO series about these people in prison?
Yeah, but I never watched it.
Yeah, and it was always interesting to me. Whoever wrote that, like they just didn't understand, like they don't really understand Nazi ideology or white supremacy. Like they just, so I remember there was a scene in that in which there was a Jewish guy and the blacks were on one side and the whites were on one side and the Jewish guy like didn't know where to go. And the neo-Nazis, you know, said like, oh, you know, put your hand, you know, you're white, you're here. And I'm like, no, like they would absolutely not do that. Like if anything, they hate Jews more because they look at them as parody because they're an actual danger. Mm-hmm. Whereas they look at just other people as, you know, some people they call mud people or, and then there's blacks as they call.
Right.
So it's interesting to me that just using that as an example, when I see or when I watch something, it's not like the views of people of people who actually hate Jews aren't really portrayed in a kind of way that's historically relevant.
They're caricatured.
Yeah,
there was, you know, Jews in 2024, they are not worried about, you know, walking down the street and getting beat up by a member of the KKK. Jews today.
I wonder how many. Find out how many members of the KKK there are. Do we know how many neo-Nazis there are? Are there more than 15,000? How many are there?
Jews are worried about being beat up by black people in Brooklyn. Jews are worried about going onto their college campus and being called a colonialist or a baby killer or an apartheid enabler. That is what Jews are worried about.
An apartheid enabler. Okay, so here we go. According to this, there's between 3,000 and 6,000 KKK members. I'd say that's, well, it's probably about right. But there's certainly not more than 10,000. So this is a very small fringe group of maniacs.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's a fringe group. But, you know, I just have to say, as somebody who kind of exists in the conservative community, I do see a lot of far-right anti-Semitism. But it's so much easier to spot. It's easier to react to because it's easier to spot, and so it doesn't get so far because there's because we've been taught about it, and so we've been taught how to identify it, and so there are checks in place. People will
give me an example, like what, like you so you're in a conservative group, and like what some
well like Christian say, for example, like Christian conservatives. There's a lot of people who, you know, when I went on my own show as a guest on Epoch Times, there was a lot of people who said in the comments like Jews killed Christ, or you know, like just there was a lot of like Christian anti-Semitism. But, you know, that's just so classic, and everybody knows about that stuff. So then there's people, other people who reply and keep those people in check, you know?
Or
people talking about the Rothschilds, or, Jews pushing globalism, or, you know, or all the bankers, you know, or push, you know, Jews are the people that push the vaccines. I mean, it's just that stuff is very kind of, bombarded with that stuff every day in the mainstream media. That is the anti-Semitism that the mainstream media does cover, is the anti-Semitism coming from the right. And so we can recognize it.
So, to a comment and a question. So I became somewhat friendly with this guy who is, I don't want to say his name, but he's a very high player in the conservative movement. And he said something, he told me this a few years ago, just completely blew my mind. He said, because I, up to that point, I was, and I, let's just assume that he's telling the truth. I just always assumed that people who were, you know, super conservative, this guy's super conservative, just had some kind of racism in them. Mm. And he said that he had never heard anybody in even the most conservative spaces say anything negative against blacks. And I just, it completely blew my mind. Like I just, to the point That's of like, I called BS on him. I said like, I just simply cannot believe, I'll tell you who it is after
the
show.
Yeah, interesting.
So
I don't think I have either. You know where I've heard it? I've heard it in some kind of ultra religious Jewish sectors, but that's not like political conservatism, right? That's like religious conservatism.
Okay, so have you heard somebody, because you said you run in conservative circles, and I actually don't. I know people think I do, but I actually don't.
Right.
So have you heard people say like anti-Jewish things, not knowing you're Jewish or...
Oh, all the time.
Like what?
There are new, and especially now after, you know, October 7th, there are new strains of anti-Semitism that conservative Jews are seeing pop up within the conservative movement that are very, very troubling.
Give me an example.
Okay, so there are this has more to do with Israel. There's the neo-isolationism we can get into. There's also among like the health freedom movement, and many of those people were kind of like previously left wingers, and now they've been, you know, black pilled or red pilled or whatever. There's kind of like a strain of this Jewish globalist cabal charges, you know, within that movement that I'm seeing pop up. I'm kind of seeing new strains of it. Whereas one of the reasons why I switched from one of the reasons, not the exclusive reason, but one of the reason I went from being like a Bay Area Democrat to like a DC conservative is because I felt more comfortable as a Jew among conservatives.
You're saying something changed.
Well, no, but I still identify very much as conservative, but as we're seeing fissures and fractures within the party over various issues, like especially Israel, I'm seeing a lot of kind of classic tropes come out, just kind of like rebranded and stuff, you know, among conservatives. And they don't know. They don't know. They don't know their anti-Semitic tropes, you know? It's very much ingrained in us to have somebody to blame for our problems.
Okay, so you mentioned before about the Soviet Union college campuses. So Can you please tell me about the Soviet Union mm-hmm. and its influence on college campuses? And somewhere in that answer, if you want to throw in, is wokeness more Soviet or Maoist, mm-hmm. or just what's going on with mm-hmm. with the Soviet Union influence on Jew hatred on college campuses?
Right. Right. And I think your listeners would be really interested to know this, presumably because, you know, they're interested in higher education and probably a lot of them have read James Lindsay's book, right? The Marxification of Education. Yeah. So a lot of them are probably aware of what an incredibly vast role that the Soviet Union has played in influencing what is taught in higher education today. And that applies to how college administrators and faculty see Jews as well. Why? Because the Soviet Union, we have to look at it in the context of the Cold War. Okay. But what I want to say is, just to preface that history, is that when we see all of the anti-Zionist protests today on college campuses, and they're holding these signs with these slogans like "From the River to the Sea" or right. "Zionism is racism," right? The world looks at that, and I think generally they think that this is some sort of like grassroots movement that is oriented around human rights,
right,
in support of the Palestinians.
Right.
Most people don't know that this is a top-down, calculated, global, incredibly well-funded campaign that originated in the late 50s and really ramped up in the 60s by the Soviet Union. Now let's go back in time. After World War II, the State of Israel was reestablished in 1948, right? This was also the beginning of the Cold War, right? The war ended and you had two global superpowers, the Soviet Union and the US, right? And they were all looking for their, you know, spheres of influences and their spheres of influence around the world, right? Where they could, you know, different fronts, right? That they could control and they could have their stake in. And there was a question about who the new State of Israel was going to ally with. Were they going to be on the side of the Americans right. or the Soviets? Right. Right. Many people thought they were going to be on the side of the Soviets because there are very socialistic elements within Israeli society, even today, but more so in the early years. Like, for example, kibbutzim, right? People think of the kibbutzim as kind of one of the only working examples we have of communism today, right? These very kind of small communes, these villages that, you know, are spread out throughout Israel where, you know, everybody works together and knows each other and they all kind of collectively exist, right, as a very tight-knit community. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of privatization. The state really owned everything in the beginning years. So people thought that Israel was going to ally with the Soviet Union, which is why the Soviet Union was actually like the first state to recognize Israel. But surprise, surprise, Israel allied with the U.S. And this was a huge blow to the Soviet Union because this was going to be their stake in the Middle East, right? This was like a new, like a blank canvas that they could control, right? That could help them, you know, spread their ideology throughout the region, right? So this was a massive blow and the Soviet Union had to find some way to counter it. So they did this in a number of ways. Number one, they started arming all of Israel's enemies, right? All the Arabs, all the Arabic groups and nations. They created a lot of these anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian, you know, nationalistic groups like the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and a lot of terrorist groups, you know, today that were trained by the Soviet Union. Then they also did something else, which is what the Soviets do best, which is they launched a massive propaganda campaign, a global propaganda campaign. And this is so well documented because it's not like they hide it. We have all of the resources. We have all the information. And there are incredible like historians and researchers such as Isabella Taborovsky, who just write at length about Soviet anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And they began this massive delegitimization campaign throughout the world to paint Israel as a pariah state. Why did they do this? Because at that time when Israel was reestablished, except for like the anti-Semites, generally there was large support, global support for the State of Israel.
So how does that play down to the college campus?
Right. So the Soviet Union had to somehow reverse that support for the state of Israel. And so what they did is they appropriated, they went to the Nazi playbook, and they appropriated Nazi anti-Semitic ideology, their posters, their messaging, their brochures, their education curriculum. They literally appropriated it.
Yeah,
they
used the same Goebbels' diaries he talks about.
They
yeah.
used the same wording.
Yeah.
They just translated it into Russian.
Yeah.
And they replaced the word Jew with Zionist. So they took all the same anti-Semitic curriculum and messaging.
Yeah.
And they switched out the word Jew for Zionist, and they spread that ideology far and wide. They didn't just spread it, they targeted group. So you know how the Soviets worked, right? They would look at the West and they would try to find, you know, activist groups or NGOs that, you know, were, you know, like hostile to America or to the West. And then the Soviet Union would seize, they would like, oh, great, these are people, they already have this, the seeds of, you know, anti-Americanism within them. And they would say, hey, we support you. And they would bring them over to the Soviet Union and they would train them and indoctrinate them into Soviet ideology. They did this with Black Power movements, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and they did it throughout Europe and South America and in Africa as well, especially South Africa. And so that's what they did in America. They took a lot of these activist groups, these like kind of like far left, you know, like socialist groups, and they trained them in their whole kind of their Soviet ideology, and anti-Zionism was a fundamental part of that. So all of these groups that were indoctrinated by the Soviet Union in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, they were also indoctrinated into anti-Zionism. It was always a part of that. It was always a component of that. And those are the people that are teaching today in our institutions.
You know, one of the things that's so frustrating to me about doing this show is that I just simply cannot find people who would defend these ideas on the left. The identitarian left to come on. I can find some people on the left who come on, but I can't find some people on the identitarian left. Like, I would love to have an administrator come on from San Francisco State and something and say, you know what, Karis, she's full of beans. This isn't true, but they won't come on. I would love to have somebody in terms of the Soviet Union and the genealogy.
But then they probably wouldn't be part of the identitarian left if they were willing to come on, right? Because isn't one of the characteristics of the identitarian left
is that they won't talk to you.
Right. They don't value viewpoint diversity. They don't value dialogue. They don't.
I keep telling myself, like, I'm not going to say this anymore, but I keep coming back to it, to saying it, because it's so it is the one thing that actually I never lose my temper. I should probably not say this, because then if people know it's going to make me lose my temper, they'll keep telling me. But I'll tell you, the one thing that really makes me lose my temper is when people accuse me of not inviting people on the identitarian left on my show. Mm. That's the one thing that infuriates me, because I literally go out of my way to do that. And the interviews are so much more interesting. They'd just be so much better if we could do spectrum street epistemology with people who disagree, because we actually have to dump many of the interviews because they're just, everybody's agreeing with everybody. And we can't find people who have substantive disagreements. But I would love that. So that genealogy of Marxism was so interesting to me. And I'd love to have someone come on and say, yeah, you know what? She came in, she's just full of beans and this is not true. Mm-hmm. But it robs me of an opportunity to understand, like, I mean, it's just like layers of.
I know. And I would love to talk to those people.
Well, they
I
won't
would
talk
love to
you.
Debate
they
those
won't
people.
Talk to you.
No, of course not. Especially because anti-Zionism is people who are anti-Zionists, they embrace this policy of what's called anti-normalization. So because they've demonized Zionists, Zionists like are just like the Jew, the Zionist is like an irredeemable, dirty, pejorative word. You know, see, here's the thing. This is why, you know, it's anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic, because they're not saying, oh, we don't like Israel's government or something like that.
Yeah.
They are saying that Israel does not have a right to exist, because at its core, its essence is sinful, is evil. It is an evil state, right? And if you,
it's
if,
not
if
the
something
penetration
is evil,
of Western values or colonialism.
Right,
it's
it is evil at its core for a whole bunch of reasons. And if something is evil, you don't, of course you would not want to engage with evil. You don't want to give evil a platform. Okay. So, you can't cure evil.
So just
you have
to be clear,
destroy it.
So just to be clear, completely clear, you're willing to do a debate or a conversation with someone who has a substantive disagreement with you about something you've said.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I would love to.
I can facilitate that, but I'm not qualified to talk about the history of Israel.
I would say most people I would be willing to talk to, and anti-Semites included. Now, there are some people that are so knee-deep into the conspiratorial elements of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Like, for example, Holocaust denial is not just like a conspiracy, like a superficial conspiracy where it's like, oh, Jews didn't kill 6 million. No. The Holocaust denialism is like an industry. Like, people write whole books about how like the Holocaust didn't happen.
Yeah, I read
happen.
David,
you know,
Irving,
I mean?
Stuff, yeah.
Okay, so the same thing is happening with 10/7.
Yeah.
There is like a whole, like, and especially on college campuses, there is a whole new burgeoning, field of 10/7 denialism, of people who deny that 10/7 happened, or people who say there wasn't rape, or people who say that Israeli soldiers did it upon themselves. And if you watch these videos and these things that people have written, they're so detailed that they're incredibly convincing. So there's videos now being creative, and they're very convincing to conservatives too. And I, like myself, I'm like, wow, I would totally fall for this if I didn't know about this. There's videos that people have put out about how it was actually the Israeli military who killed a lot of the people on 10/7. And they go through all of these elements. They say, look at this building, like, you know, Hamas just came in with like what, AKs or whatever. They could not do the destruction with this, you know, building. So of course it had to be the military, right? And so if I were to see that, I'd be like, oh my God, that's so convincing. But because I know about this stuff, I'm like, what are you talking about? Hamas came in with RPGs.
Okay.
Why wouldn't you say, you know what I mean? Okay. So there, those people, that kind of fringe group of people, I would have trouble debating because.
But why anybody listens to these people, these DEI people at all, is a miracle to me. You know, there have been three DEI administrators. Well, you know, Claudine Gay, I forget what's the other ones. Two more, the head of the DEI at Harvard,
yeah,
and the Title IX investigator, uh-huh. And the Harvard Crimson's report on that was a disgrace because I actually read her dissertation and it was completely plagiarized, and they went to the same expert source as somebody.
You read Claudine Gay's or the diversity persons?
I read the Title IX investigator's dissertation.
Oh, okay.
So in black and white, they went to the same person who said, you know, duplicative language, or that's the thing that they invented. But why anybody listens to these people about anything? I mean, I literally would not listen to them about. I wouldn't even listen to them about a food recommendation. I wouldn't even listen to them about anything.
Yeah.
But, you know, read as just...
Don't eat hummus. It's Israeli.
Okay, well done. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. So why people listen to these people at all is a miracle to me.
Yeah. But this just proves exactly what you've been screaming about for years, which is how irredeemable and corrupt higher education
Correct.
Is. It's a cult. It's just a...
It's the whole thing. It's truly astonishing to me.
It's like a self-perpetuating bubble, where, you know, like an echo chamber.
It's self-credentialized. It's like my dad told me once when I was like, he's like, my dad was a civil engineer. He's like, you know, actors, they have so many awards for themselves. They're constantly giving themselves, you know, civil engineers. We have one a year and like almost no one goes. It's not recorded. Uh-huh. That was back then where they didn't record things. But, okay. So, anti-Semitism, college campuses. One thing that I think is important, and I'll segue by means of analogy. When Barack Obama was criticized, people would say, some people would say, well, you know, you're just leveling that criticism because he's black. And I'm sure that that's partially true. But I also think it's certainly true that people were leveling criticisms because they despised his policy, whatever the policy X, Y, or Z was. So, again, I'm not an expert in this at all. It's way outside my area. People can criticize Israel and not hate Jews. Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the kind of straw mans that the anti-Zionist left likes to wage against Zionists or people who support Israel. They say that we are trying to shut down free speech and that we are saying that all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. I don't really know any Zionists, and I know like all of them, that don't criticize Israel themselves. Zionists are some of the most critical about Israel. I mean, look at Israel's parliament. I mean, they make American politics look tame. The amount of self-critique within the Zionist community about Israeli politics is incredibly diverse. This is why you like there's all different types of Zionists. This is why we have liberal Zionists and conservative Zionists. There's liberal Zionists who, you know, believe that Israel should get out of the West Bank, and they hate Netanyahu, and they're against, you know, the judicial reform stuff. And there are conservative Zionists who, you know, believe that, you know, Judea and Samaria should be annexed. And, you know, I mean, there's so much debate within Zionism about Israel and Israeli policies. This is just a straw man argument. Anti-Zionists are not criticizing Israel. If they were criticizing Israel, then nobody would have a problem with them because we all criticize Israel. What they are doing is they are operating under the belief that Israel does not have a right to exist as the nation of the Jewish people. And that is fundamentally anti-Semitic for a number of reasons. One being that we already, you know, talked about the double standard, right? Do we hear anybody ever sit around talking about whether China or Iran or North Korea or Russia has a right to exist? Mm. Of course not. These are living, breathing, functional countries. Okay. Mm. It's a country of 9 million people. Mm. Okay. You know, you can dislike Israel's government. You can dislike their policies towards Palestinians, or you can consider the West Bank occupied and think that Israel should get out or whatever. But to say that Israel has no right to exist, that is holding Israel to a standard that no other country is held to. Israel's existence is more rooted in international law than any of their neighbors.
Okay, so I'm not qualified.
Right.
I just don't know enough about it.
Let me just explain this to you. Israel's neighbors, you do intuitively know this. You know, you have a basic sense of history, and you know that, you know, these countries, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, these were all colonized countries by the British or the French, right? And these Western, you know, nations just kind of pulled out their troops and they arbitrarily kind of drew the lines and they were like, okay, now you're Lebanon and now you're, there was no votes. There was no international law, right? Israel has international documentation for the plans for its existence going, you know, as far back as the Balfour Declaration in 1917 when Lord Balfour in Britain, you know, outlined, you know, a kind of like a general plan for the way before the Holocaust,
yeah,
you know, for the creation of a Jewish state based on what he saw happening in the region, which was all this immigration from the 1800s of Jews coming into that area and cultivating the land, working the land, building a state, which drew so much more immigration from the Arab countries, which brought so many Arabs because Arabs were like, oh my God, now this is this new region, which now there's opportunities for us to work and yeah, make money. And so Jews were actually building a state. And you know, and then there was, you know, the Peel Commission and, you know, and then there was a UN vote. And Israel was created, and now it's a state. So to say that Israel has no right to exist, but every other country has a right to exist, and Israel just happens to be the only Jewish country in the world?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Strange coincidence, right?
I think I've told a story before on the show about when we got in the cab, right? The Uber. Basically, we got in the Uber, and we were filming this guy. We were in London. The guy was asking us what we were filming, you know. And, you know, I'm thinking, texting, I'm doing whatever I'm thinking. I'm thinking a million things. And, you know, the guy's like, did you know who started World War I? And I'm like, no. And he's like, the Jews. Okay, and then I pop my ears up. He's like, do you know how to start World War II? And I'm like, no. He's like, the Jews. He's like, do you know who you're paying rent to? And I'm like, who do I pay my rent to? He's like, the Jews. But then he said—
Was he Arab?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if he was Arab, he was Muslim.
Yeah.
Then I said, what did I say, Reed? Like, why don't you, are you as upset about the Uyghurs, what the Chinese are doing the Uyghurs? I said, what, did you protest that?
Right.
Do you remember that? And he said, well, they stopped. They don't do it anymore. That's what he said, right? I'm pretty sure that's what he said. And then I said, well, if they were doing it more, would you do it? And, you know, if they were, you know, genociding, or if you want to make that word a verb or whatever it is, you know, would you protest? And then he started talking about the fact that Israel itself was an illegitimate country.
Right.
And
that idea comes from, at least in the West, it comes from the Soviet Union. Not among Arabs. I mean, Arabs pretty much just believe that because they look at any non-Muslim sovereign entity in that region as illegitimate. They don't want there to be a non-Muslim, you know, sovereign there. But in the West, that idea certainly comes from the Soviet Union. People really project their own Western ideas onto that region, right? Like, we think because we've kind of like graduated from these like basic, you know, kind of these medieval kind of classic right-wing tropes about anti-Semitism, that like so has everywhere else.
Yeah.
But like Arab Muslim countries are like the most anti-Semitic countries in the world.
Yeah.
We're talking about systemic racism. Kids in Arab, and that's increasingly changing now that the Abraham Accords have happened. It's really remarkable looking at the changes in curriculum in places like Saudi Arabia or the UAE or even in Sudan and Morocco. But like Mein Kampf, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, these are like mainstays in Arabic Muslim countries. Like you will see these books in like the displays in a lot of bookshops.
Yeah, I know. Even in Canada, I plagiarized Mein Kampf, just for the record.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting how I had a guy in my class when I was teaching, and he told me he's a really, really good guy. He was gay. He had to pretend to be Muslim because they'd really kill him if they found out he was from – I don't want to tell. He was from a Muslim country. I don't want to tell you where it is. I don't think it can ever be traced back to him. But he told me that he was sick when he was younger, and they took him to a doctor, and the doctor told him that he had Jewish genies in him. It's like an it's like an MD. I said it was a guy
That's
in
amazing.
MD. He's like, yeah, he's an MD. He's like, and they weren't just regular genies. Jeez. They were Jewish genies. And I was struck by that. And you know, people over
That's
the years
That's going to be my new band.
The Jewish genies. Yeah, that's a good name. It's a good name. I hope I get free admission to your shows. but it is interesting. You know, we're very good about talking about racism against certain races. And we're
and
not
in the U.S.
And in the U.S. I had an idea for something that I would do that I think would be really interesting, but it would take a lot of time and have to be funded. And I'd do it with Reed. And one, I do everything with, well, not everything, almost everything. Just to clarify.
You guys are jumping in the shower together?
Just to clarify. although I am sleeping in Reed's bed now. But absent Reed. Reed is not sleeping in the bed with me. But anyway, I had an idea for a show.
I told you, the sexual innuendo.
They keep going. Well, that wasn't even an innuendo. But so I had an idea for a show, and that instead of going out to film when we were in London, what we would do is we would just take Ubers everywhere. We would literally just get in the Uber and start talking to people. And if they weren't, like, we could look at their name and we would just cancel the Uber and get another one. And we'd do that like 8 hours a day.
Wait, if they weren't what?
Well, you know, if their name was like Mohammed or something. And then we would just record them. You have to make sure you don't break the law, obviously. You have to make, you know, because I don't know what the rules are about recording. And we would just release those conversations.
Just to kind of give people an idea about like the Muslim culture that they come from?
I just want to be crystal clear. I have no animus against Muslims. Like literally none. I have a very good friend of mine who's Muslim. I know
that
sounds
trite. Isn't
it sad
that we even have to say this?
I know. I mean, like, I train.
You have to put like a disclaimer on it?
I train with Muslims in MMA or jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. I have like no. I do, however, think that there is a problem with importing a large number of people, particularly men of a certain age who particularly don't have a skill set so they can make money, who have fundamentally anti-Jewish attitudes.
Anti-Jewish, anti-Christian, anti-Western.
I think that's a problem.
Of course,
and I think that
because
that's,
they're threatening to destroy the Judeo-Christian values that the West is based on.
And the idea then that like, you would bring large numbers of people over here and somehow that the hammer blows of modernity would liberalize them. That's completely insane. Well, I mean, it's anti-empirical.
It's anti-empirical, and it's also insane if you live in a multicultural system. Like, if you don't live in a system where you have immigration laws that kind of forces people to assimilate, which Western Europe does not, then they're absolutely moronic to believe that people are just going to naturally take on the values of the nation and of the country.
I just want to be completely clear. I don't buy into any of it. I don't buy into I don't buy into the idea of sacred. I don't buy into the idea of holy. I don't think there's a God. I think the whole thing is silly. I'm not harboring any animus against people for their metaphysical beliefs. I think all metaphysical beliefs are pretty much asinine when it comes to religion. So I'm not targeting a group of people and saying, I'm saying that I think that there is a problem with, I mean, you can look at maps when large numbers of, and the fact is it's Muslims. They go into particular places of the world and Jews flee, like Malmo, Sweden. I think that's a problem. And I think not saying that as a problem is not only dishonest, but it's doing a grotesque injustice to the Jews who live in those regions.
There's not that many Jews left outside of the U.S. and Israel. And over the past decade, especially since the Syrian civil war, when large numbers of Syrian refugees started flooding into Europe, you started seeing drastic increases in Jew hatred, in anti-Semitic incidents, and Jews started fleeing to Israel and to the U.S., especially in places like France.
When
you import migrants who are raised on anti-Semitism, you are putting your Jewish inhabitants at risk.
Okay.
That's what we see happening today on the streets in Britain.
So, and when I spoke to, Eric Kaufman about this. I've spoken to Matt Goodwin about this. I'm not, Pauline, and I realize that there are, you can't just wave a wand. Matt Goodwin says we should have a 5-year ban on all immigrants to Britain. Mm-hmm. The Brits. I think that there are many things going on here. One, there's the fact that nobody will talk about it. And I'm not going to mention names. I've had some people on the show who refuse to say, we have a problem with this particular group of people. Gad Saad, I just love what he said. Mm-hmm. He's a good friend of mine. He said, if tomorrow Vietnam were overcome by anti-Jew hatred, would it be rational to restrict immigration from Vietnam? I've said that before, but it's just a terrific line. I think we need to start being honest about the nature of our problems. We are so far from being honest about talking about what our problems are.
We can't even diagnose it.
And the fact that I would have to say, I have friends of mine who are Jewish. I'm a little concerned for their safety. And then all of a sudden, I'm the one who's paranoid. Yeah, I'm so paranoid where I get in a cab with Reed and they're screaming about Jews. Right. I'm not fabricating this.
I understand. But think of how bizarre this is. We have gotten to a point in 2024 where if you talk about Muslim anti-Semitism, you are labeled Islamophobic.
Yeah.
Just think about that for a second. Pointing out racism makes you racist. Pointing out racism towards one minority means that you're racist against another minority. I mean,
which the times we live in. This is a friend of mine, Florence Reed from Unheard, said, we are living in uniquely stupid times. I love that line. It's just so true.
Yeah.
The whole men, women thing, the whole layers of craziness.
Right. And that actually, what we're talking about with the problems with, Western Europe and immigration and everything directly relates to college campuses in America.
Yeah.
Because one of the reasons that we're seeing, there's the Soviet Union component, but there's also the Middle Eastern foreign funding component.
Yeah, Faisal Al-Muhtar has talked about that. He's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, and the Free Press has done some great reporting on it. There's a bunch of, there's kind of independent journalists who've been talking about this for quite a long time. Middle East Forum, who I do some work with, has been, just kind of doing really investigative work on this.
I mean, I just want to be so clear right now. It's incredibly frustrating to me. I'm not talking about Israel. I'm talking about just there's a dude who's Jewish. Let's get him. Like, that's insane.
Oh, dude. I mean,
that's insane.
Man.
Anybody who that should not even, first of all, not only should I not have to utter that, like, there's a dude who's like black, let's get, like, none of that is accepted. That's the lowest threshold.
If people knew what is happening on college campuses right now and what's been happening in the last decade with Jews, they would be terrified. Let's do like a little experiment. Pick a random university. Just what's the first one that comes into your head?
Stanford.
Okay. I'll tell you about anti-Semitism on Stanford.
Okay.
I mean, literally, like give me a university
but
and I will tell you
about
it.
Tell me about anti-Semitism on Stanford.
Okay, I'll give you two things that happened. Well, okay. Actually, a report just came out that you read by Aaron Sabarium yesterday about anti-Semitism on Stanford. So
that's probably where maybe it was
there's from. Everything.
I'll give you another one then.
There's
if you don't
everything
like.
That he reported.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that was recent stuff since 10/7, but let's look at before 10/7. A couple years ago, it came out that the DEI department in the counseling, like the DEI board at the counseling department at Stanford was creating an incredibly hostile environment for Jews. So when Jews went to the counseling department to try to complain about like issues that they were facing with anti-Semitism on college campuses, they were written off.
I remember that.
They were blamed for it themselves.
I mean, DEI,
they were told
it's the source of
they
derangement.
They were told that they can't experience anti-Semitism
right.
because they are white and therefore they are the oppressors. They were told that talking about anti-Semitism is a distraction from more important types of discrimination like anti-Black racism. Okay. It was so bad. There was like so many formal complaints leveled against Stanford by Jews. Here's another thing. Student governments. Oh my God. Student governments are just I can't tell you how many Jews have been pushed out of student governments at, you know, everywhere from state schools to Ivy Leagues for not even some for being like pro-Israel and Zionist, but some just for being Jewish and like, for example, like a student government will want to vote on like a BDS resolution, a boycott resolution, and they'll tell the Jewish members to refrain from voting because since they are Jewish, they automatically must have a Jewish agenda. Yeah. These are verbatim words that they've used,
yeah.
or be biased about the topic of Israel. Okay.
Yeah.
Jews are collectively blamed for the actions of Israel.
Yeah.
Don't get more anti-Semitic than that.
Yeah.
But at Stanford, there was a member, a leader of like the student senate who said years ago, basically that the idea that Jews control the banks and the media. This was nothing to do with Israel. The idea that Jews control the economy, the media, all of our institutions is said to be a subject matter that we're not allowed to talk about, but we should talk about it because it explores like really important dynamics of Jewish control, we shouldn't not be allowed to talk about it, basically, you know? Why is he talking about this in student, like, where does the... Why is this a subject of conversation in the student senate? What does this have to do with anything, right? I'm a proponent of free speech. I don't even think that anti-Semitic premises or statements should be like off limits.
I agree.
If you want to have a conversation about whether Jews control the media or whatever, like for sure, we can have it. But the point is if it's not a good faith, if you're not coming from a place of good faith.
Not allowing the conversation is worse because that's used as evidence the
sure.
fact that it's true.
But if you're not coming from a place of good faith, like this person clearly was not, this person was not like, oh, let's like deconstruct this crazy myth and talk about where it comes from or like if there's any legitimacy to it. He was like, this has some merit to it. And because it does, that's why we are not allowed to talk about it. That was essentially what he was saying, right? And since he's coming from that place, then you end up perpetuating the hatred of the conversation because you're resting on like a fundamentally hateful premise or conspiratorial premise. But anyway, so that's like in this like student government, like, you know, that's Stanford.
Yeah. So I see.
We could do that with not even just, and not even like speech. Like there are So there are instances of, you know, members of Students of Justice for Palestine throwing rocks at Jews just like going into like Hallel buildings, right?
I can tell you one thing for a fact.
There was a Jewish dorm room that was set on fire after 10/7.
Yeah, I remember
the Chabad house was set on fire, I think, at Drexel University. Yeah. Every single year at one college campus in the United States, the Jewish fraternity house is egged.
Let me give you
on Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Yeah, well, okay, let me give you the exception to that.
Let me tell you one more thing.
Okay.
One more thing. Evidence for how anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism?
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about that. If it's not, if it's not, then how come BDS resolutions, when they vote on boycotts, tend to take place on Shabbat when Jews can't vote? How come Israeli apartheid—
Is that a fact?
A lot of times, not always exclusively. How come Israeli Apartheid Week so often aligns with Holocaust Remembrance Day? It is quite convenient that so often anti-Israel events are held on campus on Jewish holidays, specifically where Jews cannot push back or counter it. If anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, how come when some, you know, prominent influencer or celebrity or public figure goes on social media on Fridays and says Shabbat Shalom, there's always somebody in the comment that says Free Palestine? What does Free Palestine have to do with you wishing somebody a Shabbat Shalom? Like, I mean, anyway, go ahead.
No, I'm processing that. I was just wondering if that were brought up, what the response would be. But I will tell you in no uncertain terms, that is not going to happen at the University of Austin.
Yeah.
There will not be pathological, genocidal Jew hatred.
No,
at the
not with people like yourself or Gary Weiss or Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
That must be the most minimal of statements, but I think it needs to be said. And I do think that yet again, it's another example of something in which the fact that we're unwilling to have an open and honest conversation about it means that ultimately more people are going to be hurt. We're going to put, I mean, you know, it's just the same thing over and over again. And it's just so frustrating to me that there's a lack of honesty and transparency and openness about
it. Right. And, you know, and it's gotten to the point where Jews are actually kind of being pushed out of higher education. More and more parents are choosing not to send their kids.
You're good. I hope the whole legacy institution dies, as you know.
To elite colleges or even state schools because of the institutionalized anti-Semitism. Jews at campus like CUNY, which I would argue is the most anti-Semitic college
really?
In America.
Interesting.
Of the 80-person administration board, of which Jews used to make up about 20%, which is consistent with the 20% of Jews in New York City. I think they make up 20% of the city's population.
Is that really? I didn't know that.
They're gone. There's not one Jew left on the administrative board. Not one Jew left. They have all been purged. There were 300 Jewish faculty members at CUNY and administrators that resigned in protest because of, it was something to do with like Holocaust education. Like people voted against Holocaust education or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I kind of remember
Because they thought it distracted from like other genocides that were more important or something. Something to do with that. I could be wrong, but something to do with the Holocaust. And it was just so horrifying that like 300 faculty members and some administrators and a couple non-Jewish ones as well resigned.
Yeah.
CUNY is so anti-Semitic that like one year, like the state Senate, like cut funding. They cut like millions of dollars were cut from like the school, from the school's budget. It's a city university. It's a publicly funded college. And I mean,
I want to end on something that's kind of hopeful.
Okay.
If we can, something positive. I can't seem to think of anything.
Something positive. Whew.
Well, I have something positive.
Okay,
enrollment at universities is plummeting.
Yeah. I mean, you ended on a hopeful note with the University of Austin. Here's what I think.
Yeah.
As absolutely tragic and horrifying as October 7th was for people in Israel and for diasporan Jews around the world, I think a small silver lining is that it has caused people, Jews and non-Jews, you know, most who don't have a stake in this, to become aware of the problem for the first time.
I think that's true. But we need another hopeful note to end on, because I think that has a dark side too. Because as you saw from the video that we started out with, a lot of people are thinking that that was a good thing that happened, right? October 7th.
Of course.
Yeah.
You're seeing the haters come out of the closet. Don't we want to see what's actually going on?
Well, of course, but they think that they're good people.
But the rest of us are watching them and being like, oh, that's what's happening on SF State.
So I guess there's a kind of, I don't know. I've always thought that there's just something about, if somebody is honest with you that they hate people, blacks, Jews, white dudes, there's just something more honest about that.
For sure. You'd rather it come. You'd rather totally. Hatred come in that form,
wouldn't you? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that tends to be, we see that more on the right.
Yeah.
Among the uneducated.
Yeah.
We're not going to see that when it comes to left wing hatred, whether it's left wing hatred of Jews or black people, because the left couches it all in this, you know, language of human rights. They think it's like enlightened thinking. And
enlightened thinking. Yeah, enlightened thinking. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they make it more difficult to recognize.
They're not
going to just come out and say, I hate black people, I hate Jews, because they don't even think that.
Yeah, I remember one of when I was at the place I won't name where I used to teach.
That which shall not be named.
That which shall not be named in Portland. I can't remember, it was so long ago now, but I think I wrote about this in my book, my last book, but you know, the non-binary person at this place where I used to work asked a question, and I was there and I responded to the question. And then this person said, if a white man told me that 1 + 1 = 2, I wouldn't believe him. Something like that. And I remember thinking to myself, like, wow, we really have a problem here.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, at one, you know, it reminded me of this situation. I think it was Holocaust Remembrance Day. What university was it? I want to say Cornell. I'm not sure. But somebody from the Black Student Union came up to a Jewish person who I think had some sort of stall with information about the Holocaust or something like that. And he said, I really support Hitler because he killed a bunch of white people. There's so much to unpack in just that one state, right? Like, there's so many layers of that, like with what we were talking about.
Let's end on that note because I think that instead of trying to be rosy about the problem, let's just end on the truth.
Sure.
Let's just tell the truth. Yeah. Where can people find you?
I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's my last name and my first name, Rhea Karas, so just reversed. I used to write a lot of articles back in the day in various publications.
And you have a master's degree in international...
counterterrorism and homeland security, which I do not use.
Okay. All right. And you work where?
I'm a producer with the Epoch Times.
Okay.
I produce a show called American Thought Leaders and a new show that we just premiered called Fallout.
And I think you know someone who's on that show.
Yeah, it might even be premiering tonight.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
It's funny that it happened that way. And yeah, and then I work with a bunch of different nonprofit groups, Middle East Forum, Jewish Leadership Project. And, you know, increasingly since October 7th, I've just been going on various podcasts and media and talking about this. And it's wonderful to be able to talk about it to a non-Jewish or non-Israeli audience. I mean, I really feel very grateful to be able to do that, because when you're preaching to the choir, you don't always feel like you're making a difference.
Yeah. Well, know? I will tell you that if somebody is qualified and wants to have a conversation with you, I'm happy to facilitate that. I'll let you know. So I really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you. This was great.
Thank you for watching. Everything we do is under the umbrella of the National Progress Alliance, nationalprogressalliance.org. It's a nonprofit, independent 501c3. Your generous donations keep us going and keep fueling content like this. So please help us out, make a donation. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.